This podcast is from the Rand Corporation, a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. For more Rand analysis, reports, and commentary on issues at the forefront of today's policy debate, visit www.rand.org.
Hello and welcome to this Rand Congressional Briefing. I'm Wynn Burkle, Director of the Office of Congressional Relations for the Rand Corporation here in Washington, D.C. And it's my pleasure to introduce Jordan Fischbach, who will be briefing today on adapting to climate change on the coast, lessons from Louisiana for federal policy. And he'll help answer the question, what can be done to reduce the chances of widespread disaster when the next Sandy hits? And with that, let me stop talking and turn it over to Jordan.
All right. Thanks very much, Wynn. And thank you all for being here today. Good afternoon. As Wynn said, I'm going to be talking today about climate change adaptations on the coasts. And specifically, I'm going to talk about a several-year effort that we conducted to support the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority of Louisiana in developing its 2012 Master Plan for a Sustainable Coast. All right, so just a little bit of background before we dive in. As you probably know, the population of U.S. coastal counties is large and growing rapidly. Coastal counties have grown more than 45% since 1970. That's about 1.2 million additional people each year, which is like adding three Miamis to the coast every year. About 164 million Americans now live in coastal watershed counties. Note that includes the Great Lakes. At present, current estimates suggest that over 8 million people live in areas that are at immediate risk to coastal flooding. Now, overall, in addition to people, there's also, of course, a lot of our wealth concentrated on the coasts. We generate over half of our GDP in these coastal watershed counties, 58%. There's about $1 trillion of infrastructure and assets that would be at risk if sea levels were to rise 2 feet from where they are today. And specifically along the Atlantic coast, almost 60% of the land within 3 feet above, or about 1 meter above, current sea levels is planned for further development. So additional development will be there in the coming years. Now, of course, we also have other important strategic assets along the coast: military facilities, ports, power plants, refineries, oil and gas infrastructure, water treatment plants, as well as many productive ecosystems, including Louisiana and elsewhere, that provide tourism, fisheries, and other key benefits. So overall, given this aggregation of people and wealth along the coast, climate change is expected to dramatically increase risk in terms of threats to the health and safety of people, and putting more property at risk in terms of damage and destruction. Again, as I said, this is due to a combination of more and more people moving to the coastline, rising sea levels, the loss of wetlands and coastal features, which can serve as a first line of defense against these types of coastal floods, as well as what the climate science currently suggests could be possible changes in the patterns of storms, including potentially more intense coastal storms, as well as what some of the recent literature has suggested, which is that some of the storm tracks may actually start to shift northwards, away from the Gulf Coast and towards the Atlantic seaboard. Now, of these, sea level rise is probably the most substantial challenge nationwide. This is a graph taken from a recent survey of the literature conducted by NOAA. And what you can see here is that over the last 100 years, we've had about 8 inches of sea level rise, going back to 1900. That's continuing at a rate of about 1.25 inches per decade. And current projections, looking at the climate literature, suggest that we're going to see between, the more likely estimate is between 1 and 4 additional feet of sea level rise by 2100. There are also some estimates, although thought of as less likely, that more rapid melting of the glaciers could lead to sea levels as high as 6 feet or more above current levels in those scenarios. So given these risks and the complexity and uncertainty of the problem, we really see that comprehensive, long-term coastal adaptation planning is needed for many areas of the coast in order to better protect coastal residents and make them more resilient in the long term. So this isn't necessarily a new problem, and in particular, it's one that Louisiana has faced in the recent past. After the devastating hurricane season in 2005, which obviously, with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, cost thousands of lives, hundreds of billions of dollars in damage, This really spurred the state into action in 2005. And they really felt that they could no longer sort of keep going with the piecemeal planning that they had done previously. And as a result, they undertook a comprehensive master planning effort designed to reduce risk and to meet some other objectives. And that's what I'm going to describe to you today. Now, in addition to this coastal flooding problem, Louisiana also has a major land loss problem. Louisiana is home to one of the largest and most productive coastal ecosystems in the world, but over the last century, they've been losing this resource. In particular, they've lost 1,900 square miles of coastal land over the last 80 years. For perspective, that's like losing all of metropolitan Los Angeles about four times over. And the rate is about one football field of land loss every 45 minutes. The projections suggest that if no additional action were taken, this land loss would continue, with between 800 and 1,800 additional square miles of land loss over the next 50 years. Now, this is due to the combined effects of sea level rise, land subsidence, or literally the land compacting and sinking in this coastal region. And finally, it's due to the way that the Mississippi River has been managed, where the river has been channeled and levied and cut off from these wetland areas, so that what used to formerly build land in this area no longer happens, and instead there's land loss. This map here shows all the areas of coastal Louisiana that could convert to open water over the next 50 years in one of those scenarios I mentioned. So as I said, Louisiana has been aware of this challenge for quite some time, but they really struggled in the years prior to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita to address it at a comprehensive level. There were several key challenges. First, there have been literally hundreds of different types of projects proposed to either help restore the coast or reduce risk in the area. Many of them are very expensive, and they could often conflict. In addition, balancing between different objectives for the coast, including maintaining or developing a working coastline, protecting or sustaining the coastal ecosystem, and reducing risk to communities, these are all diverse and potentially conflicting goals. They have substantial uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future, given sea level rise and other key factors. And finally, they really lacked the science and the knowledge needed to understand how the coast works together as a system, and as a result, how when they started to make changes, how those projects could benefit the coast as a whole. So as a result, as I said, after 2005, they started a comprehensive master planning effort, which really culminated last year in their 2012 Comprehensive Master Plan for a Sustainable Coast. This plan is designed to simultaneously address the land loss and risk reduction challenges that I just described, and it includes several key innovations, including a new systems modeling approach to better understand how the coast works together as a system and project what future changes could look like, as well as a new objective planning framework designed to identify effective investments for the coast and explicitly note trade-offs. And I'll get into each of these in a moment. So first, I wanted to just give you a sense of the type of project that's been proposed for coastal Louisiana. In terms of coastal restoration, projects are typically designed to either reduce the rate of land loss, build new land, or otherwise reconnect and restore coastal processes. In particular, there's two types of projects commonly used for building land in the region. One of them is literally to pipe sediment directly into the marsh. And you can see here's a pipe literally that's just blowing sediment out into the marsh to create new marshland. This process is called mechanical marsh creation, and it can be very expensive. It typically costs between $50,000 and $200,000 per acre. The other main type considered for coastal Louisiana are known as river diversions. And this is basically building diversion gates, as one of the example here, into the levees on the Mississippi River or one of its distributaries, and opening those gates during floodwater or high flow periods in order to essentially reconnect the river back to the floodplain and allow natural flood land building to occur when there's a lot of sediment in the river to wash out. Again, this can vary greatly in cost depending on the location and size. Now, in terms of reducing risk, there are also two sort of main goals. One is to, in some places, prevent flooding from occurring. And in others, it's to reduce the damage that can occur if a flood actually happens. Now, for the former, typically large public infrastructure investments are used to prevent floods from occurring in the first place. This visual example here is actually from New Orleans. And here we have an example showing basically levees. This is a levee interconnecting here. A gate system with some pumps in it. And then there's actually a canal behind that feeds those pumps and pumps out the interior of this area. But essentially, this is what's sometimes referred to as structural risk reduction. And it's designed to use these levees, flood walls, gates, and pumps to more or less keep water out. Again, this can vary a lot in cost depending on the size and scale. But for perspective, the Corps of Engineers spent about $15 billion after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 to repair and upgrade that system. Now, the other main type is to reduce damage in the event a flood occurs. This is sometimes referred to as non-structural risk reduction, and this is confusing because it's still a structure, but it's non-structural because it's not large public infrastructure. And these are investments designed instead to promote local resilience and make individual structures less susceptible to flood damage. And it can include, as you can see here, elevating homes, flood-proofing of homes or businesses, or actually acquiring and or relocating structures in very high-risk areas. And just for perspective, this typically costs about $46,000 to $170,000 to elevate an existing 1,600-square-foot home. So given this diversity of projects that were proposed and the state's need to develop this comprehensive plan, they approached RAND about 3 years ago to help develop an approach that would take all these factors into account. And in particular, we did two things. First, we developed a new model of hurricane flood risk looking out long term that's designed to bring in a lot of the uncertainties that haven't previously been addressed. And second, we developed a comprehensive planning framework and a planning tool to help prioritize investments. Now, I won't go into the details of the model, but overall, what we found using this flood risk model is that over time, we're seeing substantial increases in both flood depths and flood damage across the coast if no additional action is taken. In particular, what you're seeing here is just an example map showing one scenario of flood risk 50 years from now from an event with a 1% annual chance of occurring. And what you can see is that for most areas of the coast, this is in yellow, you see at least 1 to 5 feet of flooding. And the darker shades show deeper flooding, which can be upwards of 25 feet. This is also true in terms of damage. We evaluated damage in terms of expected or average annual damage across the Louisiana coast, looking at current conditions and also looking at two future scenarios reflecting different assumptions about sea level rise, rates of land subsidence, and other key drivers for the area. What we found is that under current conditions, average annual damage across coastal Louisiana is about $2.2 billion, and this is in constant 2010 dollars. If we look out 50 years under a moderate scenario, reflecting moderate assumptions about, in particular, sea level rise, this damage triples. So it's about $7.2 billion 50 years from now in this moderate scenario. If we look in a less optimistic scenario, it could increase almost tenfold if no additional action is taken. So we used, actually, let me take a step back here for a minute. We used these models, and the risk assessment model was one of actually seven different systems models used to understand the coast together as a system. And we use these models to evaluate a future without action, as well as a series of different projects that were proposed for the coast. And we literally looked at hundreds of different projects. And all of that information was consolidated and brought into the next step, which was this planning framework and planning tool. The planning tool is a custom designed software tool that RAND developed for Louisiana. That's designed to take all this information and do three things. First, it compares and ranks the individual projects according to cost effectiveness. Second, it helps select different combinations of these projects for potential strategies, coastwide strategies. And finally, it uses a series of interactive visualizations to help show decision makers and stakeholders in the region key trade-offs to support decision making in real time. So overall, what we did with the planning tool was compare hundreds of different restoration and risk reduction projects. Just to give you a sense, and I'm sorry if the symbols are a little small here, we looked at 43 different river diversion projects, which are the little blue stars there, over 100 marsh creation projects, about 100 other restoration project types, 34 structural risk reduction, and over 100 communities that were considered for additional non-structural risk reduction investment. Now, of course, implementing all of these would be very expensive. It would cost over $200 billion. And many of these projects could actually have duplicative outcomes, or they could directly conflict. So what we did with the planning tool instead was try to select combinations of these projects, a subset, that would best maximize both land building and risk reduction. It does this while also trying to balance across other objectives, including maintaining coastal habitats, support for navigation along the river, as well as providing risk reduction for important historic or cultural heritage sites. And finally, it takes into account constraints. So the tool is able to account for what different levels of funding might be available to support this plan. It can constrain these types of river diversions to ensure that there's adequate flow in the river for navigation. And finally, given the amount of land building that needs to occur in the region, it can take into account what amount of sediment might be available from external sources to build land sustainably and not just take sediment from one part of the coast to the other. So if we use this planning tool and just ask the question, which projects should the state choose to maximize risk reduction in land building using a $50 billion budget, this is what we found using this tool. As you can see, there are projects from each different project type that were selected, and there's a fairly good balance of these projects in different areas of the coast. Now, what we found just using this initial approach is that relative to a future without action, we could see substantial land building. So here what you're looking at is a graph showing the total land in the coastal study area over a 50-year span in that moderate future scenario. So you can see declining land all the way throughout that process, losing about 800 square miles of land in total. With that initial alternative that I just showed you previously in place, this rate of land loss would be substantially slowed and actually eventually would be reversed, and we would see land building in the future decades. Now, there are trade-offs involved with this, of course. if we were to do it as is, I'll take a step back here. First, one thing to note is that not everything is going to decline in the future if no action is taken. So if we have, for example, saltwater species like shrimp or oysters, they actually might do a little bit better in that future, because a lot of areas that are currently sort of freshwater are going to become more ocean habitat, and there might actually be more room for them. And this is represented sort of notionally here with this increasing line in a future without action for the saltwater habitat. If we were to do that initial maximized land building strategy, which includes a number of river diversions, this habitat would decline. And the reason is because now we're putting a whole bunch of freshwater into these areas, and areas that were saltwater habitats would no longer be, and we would lose some of that habitat. So this represents a potential trade-off. And what the tools allow us to do is sort of loop back and say, okay, well, what if we wanted to try to maximize land building, but without including some of these very large river diversion projects? So again, we were able to do this almost in real time, come back, look at the tool, and say, let's do the same thing, but now we won't include any river diversions. And as you can see, here's the results of that, where now we don't have river diversions and the investment is spread across other types of projects. Now, doing that, we could substantially reduce the impact on saltwater habitats. But if we were to do that, we also wouldn't get the land building that we saw previously. So now we get land outcomes that are better than what we saw in a future without action, but not necessarily sustainable in the long term. So this is actually just one example of many different types of trade-offs that were looked at throughout the planning process. And this one was resolved in particular by including some river diversion projects, but not including some of the largest river diversion projects that might have a substantial impact on these saltwater habitats. So as I said, this is just an example of the kind of analysis we were able to do with this planning process. And what happened over a very intensive 3 to 6 month span is that RAND used the planning tool to formulate a group of projects based on all that information about project benefits from these models. We provided a series of interactive visualizations, which then went to a core planning team at the state of Louisiana, as well as a team of stakeholders that they'd assembled over a several-year period. They used this information to discuss these key trade-offs in real time, and then they would go back to the RAND team and say, okay, well, we want to see a slightly different set of constraints. You know, we want to look at a different a budget level. We want to balance these things a little bit differently. And once again, we were able to loop back through, provide an alternate plan that met those objectives, loop through this many, many times over a 3 to 6 month span, and eventually settle on the final master plan. So this process turned out to be very successful and very effective for allowing Louisiana to reach a comprehensive plan. The Louisiana Master Plan is a 50-year, $50 billion plan that was actually passed unanimously by the Louisiana legislature in May of 2012, and it's currently starting implementation. The plan includes about $30 billion of investment in restoration projects, including marsh creation, river diversions, and other types of restoration, as well as about $20, $21 billion called for in risk reduction investments. And these are balanced evenly across structural and non-structural risk reduction. One important note here is thinking about this relative to the past. If you were to look at investments in coastal Louisiana in infrastructure prior to today, you would see that this red wedge dominates. Typically, most of the investment has been in levees. And the scale of investment called for in these restoration projects, as well as in non-structural risk reduction, is really unprecedented for coastal Louisiana. And it could be very effective. Once again, going back to our moderate future scenario, now here we're looking at a graph showing the rate of land change on a decade-by-decade basis in terms of the change in land area. And what we find is that the master plan could really stop or reverse this coastal land loss. In this scenario, we actually do see increasing land for the first time in those latter two decades. This is also true in terms of flood risk reduction. Across both the moderate and less optimistic scenarios, with the master plan in place, we're able to substantially reduce risk relative to, and this is risk in terms of damage, relative to a future without action, and at least maintain or reduce risk relative to current levels. So overall, what we found through this process is that it allowed Louisiana to take a step forward in terms of comprehensive planning, adaptation planning, that they were not able to do before. And really to make some difficult choices about how the coast was going to be sustained in the future and basically picking amongst what would be done. So in particular, they had a lot of uncertainty and a very complex coastal system. And through this process, they were able to gather an enormous amount of scientific information about future risks and benefits to support this kind of planning. And that's information that they're going to continue to use for years and decades to come. Now, given what I mentioned before, the challenge of hundreds of different proposed projects and everybody's pet project in each parish, this allowed them to provide an objective way to prioritize investments and just note that not all areas of the coast were going to receive the same level of investment or basically have their pet project funded. And finally, given the diversity of stakeholder interests, as I mentioned before, this actually provided them a very open and science-based process and really a non-political process designed to help them resolve trade-offs. Now, of course, not all areas of the coast are going to be saved, and not everybody came out of this plan 100% happy, but this really allowed them, through this process, to bring all those views together, include stakeholders, give them the scientific information, and eventually settle on a consensus plan. And we think that this is an approach, both in terms of the tools and the planning approach applied, that has a lot of relevance for other regions. And is particularly relevant for the mid-Atlantic coastal states after Superstorm Sandy. In particular, we see a few key lessons coming out of this. The first is that as a proof of principle, investing in this type of comprehensive risk reduction strategy really can help protect people and infrastructure. And in particular, it can help to reduce post-disaster costs after future storms like Sandy. Second, again, is sort of a proof of principle. This plan includes a number of things that are designed towards a sort of defense-in-depth idea, a multiple barriers approach to coastal risk reduction that says we shouldn't be solely reliant on levees, but instead we need a combination of efforts to make them more resilient in the event that levees, don't necessarily work as intended. So this plan includes substantial investments in restoration and risk and non-structural risk reduction that does provide that defense in depth. And finally, what this really suggests is that given the amount of uncertainty, particularly about sea level rise for these coastal areas, that the goal for other areas of the coast should be to seek robust strategies that perform well regardless of what that future scenario might be. we need to invest in such a way that if sea level rises 1 foot or 4 feet over the next century, that these plans will work well and these investments will be effective. And that suggests that we need strategies that are robust to some of these key uncertainties. All right, well, that's all I have for today. So I'm happy to open the floor for questions. Thank you.
This presentation is provided as a public service by the RAND Corporation. Visit www.rand.org to learn more about these issues and to explore RAND's free online library of more than 10,000 policy reports and commentaries.